For those of you viewing at home, I had the mic off, and so you missed my excellent little introductory patter about the ominousness of the title and how the talk itself would be fairly whimsical. Anyway, as I was saying, we're going to talk about a slightly weird technical problem that turned out to be perhaps more interesting than we expected, and maybe a little bit more difficult than we expected in some ways. So any feedback will be more than welcome. The more so since this is, to a degree, work still in progress. I gave a version of this talk at QPL this summer, and a sort of extended abstract, a short version of the paper, can be found at the on the archive, as indicated down there, as part of the conference proceedings. But there's definitely more to do, and hopefully we'll get to do them. Okay, so. Let's talk about local tomography, or as Lucian has been persuading me, what should probably better be called tomographic locality. I'm still going to call it local tomography because that's what the slides say. This is the doctrine that says if you have two perhaps space-like separated physical systems, A and B, you should be able to ascertain the joint state, the state of that composite of the two systems just by making local measurements on A and on B, and then maybe collating the results and doing statistics. Now, this is certainly a feature of classical probability theory, where effectively we just have two sets and we're taking their Cartesian product. And it's also well known to be a feature of complex quantum mechanics. But it fails for real quantum mechanics, what I'll call RQM. And this is well known. This has been known for a long, long time. I think it might have first been pointed out by Sakai back in the 50s even, or early 60s. And it's often brought forward as a reason why we should prefer complex quantum mechanics to its real, or for that matter, quaternionic alternatives. And not only is this well known, it's also easy to see. It's very easy to see on dimensional grounds. If you simply count the dimensions of the state spaces of the relevant composites, in complex quantum mechanics, those dimensions multiply as they need to secure local tomography, and they don't in real quantum mechanics. But to start off with, I thought it might be helpful if we looked just a little bit deeper into the reasons why local tomography fails for real quantum mechanics. Incidentally, before I advance the slide, I want to say one more thing I should have said at the beginning, which is interruptions are fine. Just, you know, if you have questions, just shout them out. Okay, so let's suppose we've got two, say, finite dimensional real Hilbert spaces, they're finite dimensional, so they're automatically complete. So two finite dimensional real inner product spaces, H and K. I'm going to use this notation. This doesn't seem to be pointing to anything now. Oh, that's all right. So I'll use this notation, L sub S and L sub A of such a space H, to stand for the space of symmetric operators on H and the space of anti-symmetric operators on H. Okay? So symmetric operators, you know, A star equals A, anti-symmetric A star is minus A, and you know, it's standard that the space of all the operators on H breaks up as a direct sum, LS, direct sum, LA. Everything's a sum of operators of those two types, right? Okay, so let me use this shorthand notation, LSS, to stand for the tensor product of the symmetric operators on H and the symmetric operators on K, right? Symmetric on both sides. And LAA is going to be the tensor product of the antisymmetrics on the two sides. So far, so good? Well, you do a little computation with the direct sum decompositions that I just mentioned, and what you find is that the symmetric operators on H tensor K is the direct sum of symmetric tensor symmetric and antisymmetric tensor antisymmetric. Let me just pause there for a moment. Is it clear to everybody that if I take the tensor product of two anti-symmetric operators, that is a symmetric operator? Okay, so that's basically what's going on. All right? All right, just for later reference, this isn't just a linear direct sum decomposition, it's an orthogonal direct sum decomposition with respect to the trace inner product. So if you take the trace of symmetric tensor symmetric times antisymmetric tensor antisymmetric, you get zero. Right? So far, so good? All right. Well, effectively, that explains the problem. The problem is this factor here. So let's say a little more about that. If we have a density operator representing a joint state on each tensor K, then it splits up uniquely as a sum of a component in LSS and a component in LAA. And if we have two effects representing measurement outcomes, two positive operators between 0 and 1, let's say little a acting on H and little b acting on K, well, their tensor product is in LSS, right? It's two symmetric operators tensored together. And so that tensor product is orthogonal to anything in LAA, including little rho sub AA. So rho sub AA is contributing nothing to the probability of seeing A tensor A. In fact, the probability of seeing A on Alice's side and B on Bob's side in this state rho is just the same as the probability of seeing that sort of product effect in rho SS. Yes?
Just to check, if the first line says rho is a density operator,
yeah.
It doesn't need to be symmetric or antisymmetric, just any density operator.
Any density. Well, it is symmetric on H tensor K. Because density operators are self-adjoint, right? So, yes.
These are all real.
These are real.
So
self-adjoint means symmetric.
Just means the transpose.
Yes, yes. If you like, if you want to think of these as matrices, they're.
There's no taking.
There's no conjugation. You can't because everything's real. Okay, so that's the sense in which, yes, it's symmetric because in the real context, symmetric means self-adjoint.
I see.
And vice versa.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So that means that if I have two states, you know, rho one and rho two, both split up this way, if they have the same symmetric tensor symmetric component, then they're going to assign the same probabilities to all of these local pairs of local effects. In that sense, states that have the same LSS component are locally indistinguishable in real quantum theory. Yes?
Which part of this logic fails in the complex?
That's a great question. I was kind of hoping somebody would ask it. So can I use the board for a minute to address that? Okay, so let's look at the complex case. So suppose H is complex. So in that case, I'll still use the same notation, but this now means not anti-symmetric, but anti-self-adjoint, okay? That is I times the symmetric things, right? Right? You can multiply by I to convert symmetric or self-adjoint into anti-self-adjoint and vice versa. Yes? Okay, and so that means that this direct sum decomposition looks, which is still, in a sense, true if we restrict scalars to the reals. It looks more like this if we allow complex scalars, right? In other words, the decomposition is just not there anymore, right? It's just LS. So that's what goes. That's what happens in the complex case. You don't have these two factors, right? Another way you can say this, maybe more briefly, is that LS, the space of anti-self-adjoint operators, is not a, in fact, both of these, LS and LA, neither of them is actually a subspace of the space of operators as a vector space over the complex field. Right? In other words, these are real subs. So let me say that perhaps less cryptically. if script L is script L of H, where H is this complex Hilbert space, then this space as well is complex, right? It's a complex vector space. And the self-adjoint operators are not a complex subspace of L. Because if I multiply by certain scalars, like, for instance, I, that takes me out of the space, okay? So this whole sort of decomposition is invisible if you're using complex scalars. If you take your complex Hilbert space and you restrict your attention to real scalars, it comes back. But of course, in quantum mechanics, that's not what we do. We use the complex scalars, all right? So actually, I'm glad that question came up because I want to actually return to these issues at the very end in the context of a question, right? Any other questions from you guys before we proceed? Yes, sir.
Can I think of this as a gauge symmetry?
It's possible. The sad truth is, my training being mathematical, when physicists say gauge, I find myself in a small panic. What do they mean? I'd love it if somebody could explain to me what a gauge symmetry is, but I have tried to ask that question before, and so far my head has proved too thick. So, but you know, ask me again afterwards when I can ask you some questions back. Okay, so at this point, we should be seeing kind of a move, right, that we could make. If we like local tomography, and for some reason we're interested in fooling around with real quantum mechanics, which isn't locally tomographic, why can't we just, going back here, why can't we just factor that out? Why can't we just drop it and just do our work here? Well, that's the question, right? Can we just factor out these non-local degrees of freedom that are all contained in this subspace LAA in order to obtain a locally tomographic probabilistic theory of some sort? It turns out, yes, we can do this. With a caveat that I'll come to in a moment. Lucien, did you have a question?
No, I was thinking about what you meant by factor out, but I guess you'll explain that in time.
Yeah, well, in a naive way, what I mean by factor out is when you have a direct sum decomposition of a vector space, if you just project onto this factor, that's the same thing as taking the quotient of the vector space by this subspace. So you can think of it as factoring it out. So, but if you don't like that language, project onto. Why can't we just project away the...
But you're going to explain how this works in more detail.
I'm going to explain how this works in more detail. But yeah, but that's sort of one's first inclination when you see something split up as a direct sum of something nice and something not so nice is to say, well, get rid of that. Yes, it's a direct sum, so I should be able to isolate and remove the bad stuff. Okay. So that's sort of the program, is to try to do that. And I claim that it can be done. There is a caveat, which will kind of emerge as we go. The caveat is that we will have to sacrifice some things from real quantum mechanics in order to make it work properly, although I have some ideas as to how to put them back, but that is for the questions at the end. Okay, moreover, the recipe that I'm going to use, or the method I'm going to use to carry out this program, doesn't just work for real quantum mechanics. It turns out that it works, hey Rob, it works in great generality. It works for pretty much any non-locally tomographic GPT at least in a certain framework, okay? So I actually want to show you how that goes, because I think that's part of what's interesting about this. But that's where we're going. So when you carry out this sort of factoring out process, you get a locally tomographic theory, and we've taken to calling that the locally tomographic shadow of the original theory, all right? And there should be, for at least those of you familiar with it, a little bit of an echo here of Plato's cave, right? The idea is that the shadow is sort of what the local observers see. who have no access to, you know, the global degrees of freedom. All right, so in order for me to explain this in the detail that Lucian is requesting, I'm gonna have to say something about what I mean by a probabilistic theory. I'm guessing pretty much everybody here has had some exposure to GPTs at some level, if even just having seen a talk or two, all right? But not everybody means the same thing as everybody else by GPT. There are different frameworks. So I'm gonna say what I mean. And in fact, I'm actually going to show you a way of looking at probabilistic theories that is fairly new to me, that I think actually has some advantages and that I kind of want to advertise. So that's a sort of a secondary purpose of the talk. So we'll talk about probabilistic theories, and that's actually going to occupy probably half the remaining time. Then I'll show you how to construct this locally tomographic shadow theory in general. Then we'll go back and look at how that plays out in the case of real quantum mechanics. And then if there's time, I will regale you with some questions. Yes?
Sorry, sorry, maybe it's a stupid question, but do you think you could just explain really briefly what it means that ordinary quantum mechanics is locally tomographic?
Yes, it means that in complex quantum mechanics, if I... if I have a density operator rho, and I ask what's the trace of rho with A tensor B, where these are effects, so measurement outcomes, if you like. Alice sees A, Bob sees B. How likely is that? Well, this is the probability. If I know these, that determines what rho is.
I see. Right?
I can specify, I don't need to know the trace of rho on arbitrary effects, but only on those of this special form.
Okay, I see, good. I think I was really confused because I thought you meant you could, I thought you meant that you could just know like half of it, just rho.
No. That would be truly magical.
Exactly.
Yes,
that
yes.
So,
yeah. Okay. So, it's just that Alice and Bob are allowed to, you know, like after the fact, they can get together and share data, collate the results, and so on. But they're not allowed to make genuinely global measurements.
Yeah.
Okay, so onward. All right, so let's talk about probabilistic theories broadly. There are lots of different frameworks. Shameless advertisement, of course. There'll be this short course soon, and I will tell you in more detail about others. But for purposes of this talk, we're going to use a fairly in some ways fairly sophisticated version in which a lot has been sort of swept under the rug or hidden under a nice chassis or something, according to which a probabilistic model, the basic object that we're going to study, is just a pair V comma U, where V is an ordered real vector space with positive cone that I'll call V plus. And here I should pause to ask, are people comfortable with that terminology, ordered vector space?
No.
No. Okay, well, I'm gonna show you a picture in a moment that will make it fairly clear, but I can also give you the gory details right here. V plus is a designated subset of V, and it has these two, has actually a couple of properties. The important ones are these. I'm going to call elements of V Greek letters. So if alpha is in V plus and T is a non-negative real scalar, then T alpha is in V plus. So it's closed under multiplication by non-negative scalars, not by arbitrary scalars. And if alpha and beta are in V plus, then alpha plus beta is also in V plus, it's closed under addition, right? It's like a subspace except for this restriction on the scalars. There's another condition, which is that the intersection of V plus with minus V plus, which just means the set of all negatives of vectors in V plus, is only the zero vector. And you can begin to see now we're talking about something that is kind of cone-like. Yes, it kind of goes off in one direction. You add two things in it, you stay in it, and if you flip it around, the cone and the flipped around cone, which is also a cone, intersect at the origin. So it's a cone starting from the origin. The final thing is that you want the span of V plus to be all of the vector space V. So everything in V should be a linear combination of things in V plus. And since positive linear combinations of things in V plus are in V plus, by gathering terms, you can show that that's the same thing as saying that everything in V looks like something in V plus minus something in V plus. We call V plus the positive cone. We think of vectors in V plus as quote unquote positive. Everything in things in minus V plus would be the negative vectors, if you like. And why ordered? Why do we call it ordered? Well, first of all, because we're talking about some things being positive, but also because we can now define a partial order on V. We can say alpha is less than or equal to B, or rather alpha is less than or equal to beta, if and only if beta minus alpha is in V plus, and in that order, V plus is the set of things that are greater than or equal to zero. All right, so that's a quick tutorial, very super quick tutorial on ordered vector spaces.
As your second bullet point, it's not an arbitrary linear combination of these vectors.
Right, it's positive linear combinations, meaning those with positive or at least non-negative coefficients.
I see.
That is closed under. That's why it's not a subspace.
Okay, but all the convex closures in there.
Yes. Correct. Yeah. It is convex as a consequence.
If I take a slice through it, it's going to be a convex.
Yes. In fact, I'm going to show you that picture in just a moment. But yeah, there was that question. Yes. Go ahead.
So, does a typical vector space have does it exist a positive cone for?
For a typical vector space, there are lots of positive cones.
Right.
And so, an ordering on a vector space to turn it into an ordered vector space is extra structure. You have to pick one of the cones and say, that's the one I'm interested in.
And so does every vector space have at least one positive cone?
Yes, yes.
Good.
Yeah. Yeah. I say that. No, let me see. Let's just think about finite dimensional vector spaces because my brain won't hurt as badly if I do that. And then the answer is surely yes.
When you say many, there are many cones, you can imagine it's like
this. Yes, exactly. So you just have to pick one, okay? I want to know what constitutes a positive vector. I'm also going to pick a distinguished real, this is all, everything is real, so real valued linear functional, U. So U is not in V, it's in the dual of V. And it's going to be strictly positive. By that I mean it takes strictly positive values everywhere on the positive cone except at the origin, where because it's linear, it has to take the value zero. Right? I'm going to then define states to be elements of the positive cone on which this functional takes the value one. Rob, that's your slice. And I'm going to define effects, which are our stand-in for measurement outcomes, to be elements of the dual of V. So linear functionals on V that take values between zero and this unit effect. In that case, A evaluated at a state alpha is going to be between zero and one. Zero and U of alpha is one. And I'll interpret that as the probability of getting alpha in state alpha, getting A rather in state alpha. And I'll call U, which is in effect, according to this definition, the unit effect.
So it's kind of an assumption here that states are normalized objects.
Yes.
You could
look at subnormalized ones. And let me show you the picture now. So Rob, this is exactly, I think, what you had in mind. And so here is a cone in R2 pretending to be R3, but you know, it's just meant to be figurative. So we have this cone with a sort of circular cone. Here's zero. Here is the hyperplane U inverse of one intersected with the cone, and that's giving me this set of normalized states. Anything in the cone below that slice down here would be a subnormalized state. So this does provide me the resources to talk about those. Okay. So let's look at a quick example just to make sure this connects with something familiar. If I have a finite dimensional quantum system with Hilbert space H, this could be complex Hilbert space, you know, that's fine. This works for real or complex. Let V be the space of self-adjoint operators on H, so that's either Hermitian if we're doing complex or symmetric if we're doing real. Ordered as usual means our cone is the cone of positive semi-definite operators. And the ordering is the usual ordering of self-adjoint operators. U in this case is the trace. And in that case, elements of the positive cone that are normalized so that U of that element is 1 are just positive operators with trace 1. In other words, they are density operators. And effects, well, we have to be a little careful. Effects as I've defined them are in the dual of V. But because we've looked at a finite dimensional space, elements of the dual of V can be identified with elements of V using the trace inner product. And if we do that, then our effects are just positive operators between 0 and the identity, just the usual model. Okay? So this picture of a vector space with a cone and a normalizing functional generalizes this picture and gives us an environment in which we can talk about measurement outcomes and probabilities and states, normalized states. Now, a little remark, which hopefully won't eat too much of our time, but I want to make this because I think it's important and sometimes overlooked in some of the literature in which GPTs are associated with convex sets or sometimes these ordered vector spaces based on them. There's a more basic framework in which you can start with an arbitrary collection of sets that you think of as outcome sets for different experiments. If you take the union of all those outcome sets, you get a space, I'll call it big X, sort of a total outcome space, and a probability weight then is I think very naturally defined to be a function, call it alpha, that assigns to outcomes, real numbers that are non-negative, and that sum to 1 over each outcome set, right? Each outcome set is supposed to be a complete set of mutually exclusive alternatives, so the probability of seeing something in that set should be 1. So those are the probability weights. Once you have that set up, you can build one of these ordered vector spaces pretty simply. You let V be this, well, first of all, you let omega stand for, because you have to give a name to it, all the set of all the probability weights. It's not hard to see that that's convex. Weighted averages of probability weights are probability weights. You let V be the span of that set in the space R to the X, a fancy terminology for the set of all real valued functions on X, thought of as a vector space. Then you can define a functional that takes anything, a probability weight or any linear combination of probability weights to its sum over the elements of any of these sets in the collection. It won't depend, the result won't depend on which set you choose. And so we have a linear functional. It's pretty clear this is linear in alpha. And moreover, if you look at the preimage under this functional of the number 1, in other words, the hyperplane that this functional cuts off and intersect that with the positive cone, which just means positive things are things that are positive on the set big X, you get back your set omega. So the previous picture emerges from this one in a very natural way. Incidentally, if you haven't seen this before, it's extraordinarily striking. Gleason's theorem can be read as saying, in fact, this is very, very close to the way Gleason formulated it, that if script M is the set of orthonormal bases of a Hilbert space H, then as long as the dimension of H is bigger than 2, this construction here returns for V the self-adjoint operators and for U the trace. And so you get back the previous and familiar model. Okay? So the model, while it seems the ordered vector space model, while it may seem sort of mathematically slick but divorced from things that are concrete, actually has a very, very concrete and straightforward motivation. Yes?
What is this trace duality that you said before? Because I thought you were intending this, the Gleason theorem before, in the slide before this one.
I didn't use it before this one.
Yeah. So what is this thing that you can go to the, from the dual to the of all the functional? The
What I was using there was just trace duality. So
it means that every function that you got the vector trace, trace or something.
Yeah, yeah. So in any finite dimensional inner product space, it's got an inner product. V star is canonically isomorphic to V because if you define for a vector, let's say little v, a functional f sub v to be xv like that, you guys probably would like me to do it that way. That's a linear functional, but the dimensions are the same. This is a linear injection. It's an isomorphism. So everything in here looks like that.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So, okay, great. Yes, go ahead.
In the previous slide, you had like a construction for a generic GPT, and then you had connectivity as an example. But here, what is the assumption in this construction that gave you just quantum theory?
The assumption here, it's kind of remarkable. The assumptions here are almost none, right? Give me a collection of experiments. Tell me what the outcome set of each experiment is, right, concretely. Then I will build you one of these ordered vector spaces and a linear functional that cuts off the probability weights, the set of probability weights. Now, when you pass from this very concrete model to this sort of linearized version, you gain some things and you lose some things. You start wanting to represent measurement outcomes not by the actual things that they were, but by linear functionals on V, which for example, little x defines a functional for sure just by evaluation, and it gives you an effect. But there are lots of other effects. And you might have situations where different outcomes give the same effect, so you've lost the distinction. So you gain some stuff, you lose some stuff. It's not a totally innocent procedure, but it does, I think, serve to show why the ordered vector space models show up with such sort of insistence when you start thinking about how to generalize probability theory. Is this addressing your question? I'm not completely sure.
Right. So I think the question is more like, because Gleason's theorem says that this construction gives you precisely quantum theory,
yes,
not any GPT.
Right.
So what is the precise point in this construction that
it's part? It's the choice of M. Gleason's theorem doesn't say this gives you quantum theory for any choice of script M. It says if you choose script M to be the set of all orthonormal bases for a Hilbert space, which is one sort of naive model of quantum experiments, or at least maximally informative ones, then you get quantum theory from that. Okay. Yeah, sorry, but that was a fair question. Rob?
If you don't answer this question, this is going to slow you down, but don't I need to stipulate some constraints on the collection of outcome sets such that there actually exists some probability?
Yeah, sure. It is, actually, everything here is fine. If there are no probability weights, you have the span of the empty set, which is zero, which is perfectly good. Not very interesting vector space, so mathematically it all works. But yes, it is perfectly true that if you choose these sets incautiously, the combinatorics of the way they intersect, they don't all have to be disjoint, may prohibit the existence of probability weights. And it's not hard to write down simple examples with just a few, six outcomes I think I could do. I could do it with six.
You can do it with nine.
I can do it with six.
Yes, I can do it with six.
Yeah, you know, just cut off one of those.
Yeah.
Okay, so never mind. I'm not gonna answer Rob's question, except to the extent that I have, because it is slowing me down. And I'm having a lot of fun, but I'm also running out of time doing it. We need to move on. So here are some standing assumptions and sort of conventions that I'm gonna use in the rest of the talk. From now on, all models are finite dimensional. I'm just gonna routinely, therefore, identify any vector space with its double dual. I'm going to use this notation, except that my L's will be script. Script L superscript K of a list of K vector space is the space of K linear forms or K linear functionals on those vector spaces. That's just my preferred notation for that. Tensor product is always the linear tensor product of vector spaces. And I'm going to adopt this model for two vector spaces, V and W, finite dimensional ones. V tensor W is going to be the set of bilinear forms on V star and W star. That just means that I'm going to treat alpha tensor beta as the bilinear functional that given little a and little b in V and W assigns this product value, right? So let's talk about composites. I have models. I want to put them together. How can we define composite models? Well, a non-signaling composite of two models, V1 and V2, with their units, U1 and U2, is some model, VU, together with two mappings, a mapping M, these are bilinear, by the way, a bilinear mapping M from V1 cross V2 into V, and pi from V1 dual, tensor, rather cross V2 dual, into the dual of V, satisfying these conditions. Pi of A comma B, where you think of A and B living in these duals as maybe effects, evaluated at M of alpha beta. Alpha beta live in V1 and V2. Think of them as states, if you like. Should be this. Should be A evaluated at alpha times B evaluated at beta.
So is there a physical picture that I can...
Yes. This is going to be a... M of alpha beta is going to be some kind of a state of a composite system.
Alpha and beta are the labels of those
yes.
systems. They're not...
Alpha. No, alpha and A, no label. The system labels here are 1 and 2.
Okay.
Alpha is a state on V1. Beta is a state on V2, or in V2.
So it's like a product state?
Or... Yeah, this is a product state, basically. That's what it says.
Okay.
And in fact, I'll say that in a moment. The other consideration is that I want normalization to behave properly, so pi applied to the two unit effects should give me the unit effect. And if we want, we can extend. Actually, maybe I should back up for a moment and address what you just said. So think of M alpha beta as a product state. It's what we would normally write as alpha tensor beta. And think of A pi AB as a product effect. We'd normally write it as A tensor beta. But I'm not assuming that V is the tensor product of V1 and V2. Yes? So I can't quite do that. All right, which is why I need to call them something else. But we do have, from the fact that M is bilinear, a unique linear extension of it, which I'll just continue to call M, from V1 tensor V2 into V. So I can embed V1 tensor V2 into V, perhaps. And if I take the dual of pi, I'll get a map, a linear map, from V into the bilinear forms on V1 dual cross V2 dual, which we said was our model for the tensor product of V1 and V2. So M and pi star give you ways of relating these guys. And moreover, this condition basically says that they compose to give you the identity. Now, I'm going to refer to pi of AB as I just said, a product effect. Here it is. And I think it's a harmless abuse of notation, given what we've just said, to start writing it as A tensor B, right? Just so long as we remember that it's not necessarily living in V1 dual tensor V2 dual, but in something that maps into. And this basically just enshrines the fact that we're thinking of this as embedded in here. And so now, what does pi star do to an arbitrary state in this big composite system V? Well, evaluated at AB, it's omega of pi of AB, which we're calling A tensor B. So it's just basically omega restricted to product effects. Pi star is just restriction to product effects. That's all. And that's already, you can see, kind of localization, right? Okay, so I will call the composite V with its unit U locally tomographic. I'll say it's a locally tomographic product of V1 and V2 if product effects separate states on V just in the sense we're talking about. It's just, in other words, if omega 1 A tensor B equals omega 2 A tensor B for all effects A and B, then omega 1 equals omega 2. And that's just equivalent now to saying that pi star is an isomorphism. It's a linear isomorphism between V and V1 tensor V2. All right, is that making sense to everybody? Yeah, okay.
Just a second.
Oh, yes.
So A and B, they're states.
No, alpha and beta are states.
Ah.
Alpha, beta are states. Greek, think of it this way. Greek letters are states and little Roman letters are effects.
Okay. Right, and then omega is then a map from effects to?
Reals.
Reals.
Because it's a Greek letter and therefore a state.
Ah, right.
Okay. All right, a little quick remark about non-signaling. Why do I say it's a non-signaling composite? Because the bilinearity of everything in sight guarantees that. I think I'm going to sort of skip this slide. You can just see how that works. We can use bilinearity to construct well-defined marginals. So everything is non-signaling, just that's baked in. All right, there are two extreme cases. I think this is kind of fun and worth sharing. There's always a minimal composite, the so-called minimal tensor product, where you just take the algebraic tensor product of V1 and V2, and you equip it with the cone generated or spanned by pure tensors of states. That's fine, except there's no entanglement there. Or you can look at the so-called maximal tensor product, where you take the algebraic tensor product and you look at the cone generated by all elements of the tensor product, that is, all tensors that happen to be positive when you evaluate them on product effects. Sort of the biggest thing you could have. And there you tend to have, well, so much entanglement that it's it's absurd. At any rate, our definition of a composite can now be read this way. M going from V1 tensor V2 to V is actually positive, takes positive things to positive things if we have the minimal cone over here. And pi star is positive if we give this the maximal tensor cone. So you can think of V as, in a sense, sitting between the two, except that if we're not in a locally tomographic setting, these aren't going to be necessarily injections. They're not necessarily going to be, injections, right? So in general, this will be an injection. This will generally be a surjection of some sort. But they do compose in this order to give you the identity. All right, now I want to talk about probabilistic theories. Oh gosh, how long am I allowed to go? All right, stop. Just stop me when it's necessary, okay? Stop me when it's done. 40, well, I'm already at 45, okay. Nobody told me, I just figured it was an hour. So, all right, so a process is just a positive mapping from states to, well, from V1 to V2, positive linear mapping, that does not increase normalization. It's normalization not increasing. Things like this compose. You can take normalized states to subnormalized states. That's fine. But they compose, and every model has an identity process. So we have a category. I'm going to call it prob. It's a nice category of probabilistic models and processes. Now, notice this doesn't have any native, this category has no native kind of tensor product structure. I haven't told you how to, I've told you what a composite means. I haven't told you a specific recipe. Here is how you form the composite of any two systems. So think of prob as a nice category, but one that has no native tensor product structure. A category that has a nice tensorial structure or compositional structure is called a symmetric monoidal category. If you've seen those, great. If you haven't, I'm not going to go over it. Just say it's a category that allows you to combine things in a kind of tensor product-like way. Such categories are often used as sort of models of collections of physical systems and processes between them. They're sometimes called process theories. I want you to think of script C as a kind of category that represents whatever we think are the actual physical systems we want to model. I want to say that a probabilistic theory is a functor from such a category C to prob. So it's assigning to each actual physical system a probabilistic model of that system. I want it to be the case that it assigns to the monoidal product in C. It assigns to a composite system, as computed in C, a model which is a non-signaling composite of the models that it assigns to A and B. And it should take the trivial object in C. Monoidal categories have a kind of trivial unit object to the reals. So my idea here is that the compositional structure lives over here with the physics. And the and you can carry that across to the probabilistic models once you know how to form them. Now, I'm also going to assume that V is injective on objects, which is a technical requirement that makes it possible to form an image category. So we can look at the set of all the models and the images of all the processes under V as a subcategory of prob. And when you do that, that subcategory will have a monoidal product, the one you see given here. Okay, now it's time to construct the locally tomographic shadow and its real counterpart in 10 minutes, because I'm going to give myself until the hour. All right?
All right. But I think you have until 12:30.
Oh, do I? The room is available?
The room is until 12:30.
Okay, well, that's a bad thing you told me that. Anyway, stop me when it's time. My students always let me know by a sort of telepathic method message that somehow I think it's always correlated with a certain rustling of backpacks and so on, but at any rate. So suppose I've got a category and a functor, a probabilistic theory, even if it's not locally tomographic, we can still ask what the world would look like to local agents according to that theory. Now, in order to get off the ground with that, I do need to make an assumption. I need to assume that systems, there's a missing word, have preferred decompositions into local pieces. I have to know what I mean by local, and I have to know what I mean by saying this system consists of this piece, and this piece over here, here, and over there. Yes? Not every category lets you do that, but I'm going to assume that we have one. The technical term for this is that the category should be a strict monoidal category, or even a little more than that. Anyway, I'm going to replace C by its so-called strictification, C star, in which objects are actually finite lists of objects in the original category. So we're thinking of a composite object as coming with a list of its components. These objects are never going to be the so-called tensor unit, the trivial system, because that trivial system by definition isn't there. Yeah, it's the empty system, if you like. So I'll just keep that off the lists to make them unique. I'm going to use this notation, that's a capital pi in whatever font this is. Pi of such a list is just the product of the entries using the monoidal product in the category. It's just the composite system associated that way if we want to be definite about it.
Why the brackets?
Actually, I don't really, now that I think about it, I think that might be a leftover of something I don't really need. These are strings. Yeah, the whole point is it's supposed to be associative on the nose. Forget the brackets. You saw no brackets, right? It's just the product of these things. Actually, no, that's not quite true. The reason is that the underlying category may care about how things are grouped. So in other words, it may not be meaningful just to say A1, A2, A3 with no brackets in the category C. So I have to specify which way I want to group them if I'm going to form a composite of more than two things in C. In C star, it won't matter because we're just going to combine strings by concatenation, right?
What does it mean by a product of two lists?
Concatenation means you just stick them together, one after the other.
Just put the list together.
Yeah, put the list together, that's all.
Alex?
Yes?
Just want to get clear on what preferred decomposition means here. Like in quantum theory, I would say there's a sense in which there's no preferred factorization of Hilbert space. Like, you know, a hydrogen atom could be center of mass, relative coordinate, or the coordinate of the proton, the coordinate of the electron.
You have to choose. No, but you have to pick one.
Decomposition. You have to pick one.
Yes, and you have to pick one. And I'm basically saying I'm going to look at a category where we have picked them.
I see. So the category you picked them could represent not a theory, but rather a theory together with some conventional choice.
Yes, that's fair enough. Otherwise, it's very difficult to start talking about local tomography at all. Well, I mean, there are, that's a little overstated, but.
It's like Alice and Bob.
Yeah, yeah. Basically, I'm saying you have to specify who's Alice, who's Bob, who's Clovis, who's Dora, et cetera, Elise, Fred, all those people. All right, I need to talk about what the morphisms are. This is supposed to be a category. Morphisms in C star from a list A to a list B are just morphisms in the original category from the product of the one list to the product of the other list. That's how C star is defined. This gives you a strict symmetric monoidal category, and you use the empty string as the tensor unit if that's of interest. Okay, so now suppose that I've got a list of objects in C star with a composite that I will call just A. So A arrow is the list and A is the product of all the entries of the list. By LT sub list, I mean the mapping from the model associated with that product system to the n linear forms on the list of duals of the spaces associated with A1 through AN, the spaces where the effects live. It is basically just pi star. Remember, pi star was restriction to product effects. So that means that LT sub A takes a state omega in the model associated with the composite system to its restriction, I'll call it sometimes omega with a tilde over it, to product effects. It's something that assigns joint probabilities to lists of local effects, which we can write in any of several ways. I'm going to call omega tilde the local shadow of the global state omega. Well, I can now define a sort of local shadow state space, V tilde. It's just going to be the span of all of those things. It will turn out to be the tensor product of all the local state spaces ordered by a cone, which is just the image under this shadowing operation, this restriction to product effects of all the positive things in the original cone. So you've got this big non-locally tomographic composite cone. All the states can be evaluated at product effects. Do so. That's all. It's really, notation aside, not a very deep idea. I take my unit in the shadow to be basically the tensor product of the unit effects of all the individual systems. I get a model, the locally tomographic shadow of the original model. When I'm dealing with composites, a bipartite composite, say of...
Sorry. Yeah. You just did something really important tonight. I wasn't focusing very hard. Can you just go for that again? Because this, now you've got the word shadow for the first time. So can you...
Yeah. So, well, actually, in the previous slide, we had the word shadow.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. The shadow of a global state is the restriction of that global state to product effects, to lists of product effects.
Okay.
Right? So, and, yes?
Point of clarification on that. In the case of real quantum mechanics for two rebits,
yes.
Some eigenstate of y, tensor y, that would have been product, I can imagine something that's product in complex quantum mechanics, but here it's an entangled state, and then I would sort of project that state into the span of the products of identity x and z polys of the two qubits.
I think that's right. I think that's right. I'd want to write that on the board to be sure.
But that's the idea. Like, it's like, I'm not off base in terms of how I'm thinking about this.
I hope not, because I can't, without a little scribbling, I can't really answer you in a confident way.
Okay.
So we're just basically projecting things onto what they look like when evaluated locally. That's all. If I have two lists of systems, A arrow and B arrow, I have their two shadows. I'm going to define their composite just to be the local shadow of their actual composite in C star. So that means, in particular, that this is just the locally the LT shadow of V of AB. As a vector space, this square tensor product of VA and VB is just their algebraic tensor product, but it's ordered by a different cone. The cone is the one generated by local shadows of states in that big, you know, non-local global composite. The effect cone, the dual of this, turns out to have a nice characterization. This guy here is somewhat complicated, but the effect cone is nice. It's just the set of things that were positive effects in the original composite, the non-local composite, provided they lie in the tensor product of the of the sets of effects, provided they can be represented as elements of that tensor product. And in the bipartite case, this is what that means, perhaps a little more comprehensively. Okay, for processes, we have to be more careful. I said I was going to have to give some stuff up, and this is where I do it.
Why is it an intersection and not just the second half? Like, why is the product, things which are sort of in the tensor product enough that you have to, like, intersect it?
Here?
Yeah.
So this thing has, you know, its own cone, whatever it is. This is, you know, you take your systems, you combine them according to the category C, you look at the effects assigned to that by your model. Because we're working in a non-locally tomographic setting, there could be some global effects.
Yeah.
So don't look at those. Just look at those effects that are in here that are still positive according to this. Now, you might wonder if that would be something like the minimal tensor product or something, but it isn't. Am I addressing your question at all?
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
Why there would be effects in the product which are not positive.
Yes, and there are, and it's interesting. And we'll see that in a moment. So there's the bipartite case. For processes, I basically want to restrict my attention to processes in the original theory that that obey these equivalent conditions, which basically say they have to respect local indistinguishability. They cannot take two locally indistinguishable states and give you things that you could distinguish locally. So I'm going to call those locally positive maps. And if you have such a thing, it always descends to a linear mapping between the tensor products of the appropriate spaces. I know I'm going very fast here, but I want to give you at least a shadowy sense of what I'm doing. So those are locally positive. Basically, that gives me a way of talking about the local shadow of a process, provided the process is locally positive. There are lots of locally positive maps, but there are some maps that are excluded. One interesting case is the associator morphism in the original category. That might not give you a locally positive map, but there are enough of them to make for a reasonably rich category. I'm going to call a morphism in the original category local if its image is locally positive. And I'm going to write lock of CV for the monoidal subcategory, and it is one, you have to check that, but it is one, of the stratification C star that has same objects but only these local morphisms. Still a reasonably big category. And then, lemma, the shadow version, the shadowed version of V applied to this subcategory and going to prob is a perfectly good functor with all of the necessary characteristics to be a probabilistic theory, and it is the locally tomographic shadow of V. That's what we mean. All right, real quantum theory. I apologize for keeping everybody. It's even after the hour. But I think you'll find this kind of interesting. Let's go back to the case where we have real Hilbert spaces. And in fact, let's suppose we've got two of the same real Hilbert space, just to keep the notation simpler. I'll just write LS for LS of H. And then remember, the symmetric operators on H tensor H are just LSS tensor, rather direct sum, LAA. It turns out that in this case, if you're just doing a bipartite composite, then this LT sort of projection, which is in fact just the projection onto LSS, and it turns out that projection is just the tensor product of the two symmetrization of, or the tensor product of the symmetrization operator in itself. All right, you just, it's a computation, right? I'm not saying that's obvious at a glance. It wasn't to me, but that's how it works out, okay? Well, maybe it is obvious after a moment because sim is the projection onto the symmetric stuff.
Can you just remind me, what is LS and LA?
LS has a complicated definition that I just went through much too fast, so I don't necessarily, I'm not surprised that it's still a mystery. Oh, I mean, are you talking about LT or LS?
No, the script, telegraphic L.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So script L sub S is the set of symmetric operators on H.
And H is a real Hilbert.
And H is a real Hilbert space. LA, anti-symmetric. LSS, symmetric, tensor, symmetric. LAA, anti-symmetric, tensor, anti-symmetric. Okay. And you might have actually missed that because you came in a few minutes late. And so LSS turns out to be, well, it turns out to break up that way.
So like in the case of a qubit, identity X and Z are symmetric and Y is anti-symmetric, or poly X, poly Z, poly Y.
Maybe, I'm not sure, but.
It's like Y tensor Y has the special status in real quantum theory that, you know, Y itself has complex elements, but Y tensor Y does not. So, you know, Y tensor Y is part of the real theory of the composite, but I cannot think of it product of real amplitude.
Probably it lives here then, or has a component over here.
Lucien, have I got that right?
I think that's right. Yeah. I think that's the thing that happens here.
All right. All right. So everybody okay with sim tensor sim being our projection onto LSS? So if we do that, if we know that, then we can work out a simple example. If you take this familiar unit vector, XY is some orthonormal basis for R2. If you apply sim tensor sim to this project, to the rank one projection associated with that vector, then not terribly bad computation of a few lines tells you that you get this operator. It's one half this sort of symmetrized pair of projections plus the tensor square of the operator that flips x and y normalized by a half. Call that operator w, it's not positive. And that answers your question. Because this is an example of something that is in my shadow cone, but it's not positive according to the usual scheme. So what we've just seen is that the positive cone in the shadow tensor product of LS and LS, the locally tomographic shadow of the positive cone of, you know, the usual thing, it's strictly bigger than the usual positive cone intersected with LSS. When you take this locally tomographic shadow, you aren't just, which is I kind of think what you were thinking, you aren't just saying, oh, let's just look at LSS and look at the positive things in there. You have to look at some things that aren't positive in there. So a priori now, we've got four cones we could consider. We could look at the minimal tensor product of LS with itself, this cone here, the sort of naive version of the shadow cone, this locally the correct locally tomographic shadow cone, which is strictly bigger than that, and then the maximal tensor product, which includes every locally tomographic cone. It's not a priori inconceivable that things might collapse in this direction or this direction, but they don't. All of these embeddings are strict, and the interesting one there is the proof that this is a strict inequality, and I won't say much more, except that it's kind of cool because it uses unextendable product bases. So if you like those, that's kind of a nice application. Okay, so I've skipped a slide, but we're way over time. So some quick questions, conclusions. I think it's a nice FOIL theory. In particular, it's the only FOIL theory I know that starts with real quantum mechanics and then builds something that's rich enough to have a lot of entanglement, both for states and for effects. So it's unlike the ones you get by just using the max or the min tensor product in that way. Here are some specific questions that I think are interesting. And I'm going to kind of skip them in the interest of time, though they're here if you want to look at them. This one is kind of interesting to me specifically. There's a more general theory that I want to take the shadow of. We're starting to work on that. But here's something that I do want to finish with. Obviously, we got rid of a bunch of processes. We didn't really take the shadow of all of real quantum mechanics, but just that part that involved these local morphisms. But suppose Alice and Bob, you know, agree that their joint state is omega. That's where omega is in the locally tomographic shadow. That would be consistent with the true global state being any state in the pre-image of that state under this locally tomographic shadowing map, sort of a fiber over that state. And then if mu evolves under some global process like this, not necessarily a local process, not necessarily locally positive, then there's no guarantee that the result will be in a single fiber of the LT map on this side. It'll be some state in the image of this fiber under phi. That might cut across several fibers or pre-images over here. And so it's going to look to Alice and Bob, and Clovis and Dora, whoever their counterparts over here, as though phi acted indeterministically. Not probabilistically here, I mean indeterministically, right? Not as a function, but as something multivalued. And the question is, how does one quantify this extra layer of uncertainty and build it into the theory? Sorry, go ahead.
I just understand, what is a fiber?
What is phi?
Fiber.
Oh, fiber is just a term for a pre-image, really. So if I've got a map, if I've got a set x and a set y and some function f, and then if I have a point over here, then I've got a bunch of points that map to it, perhaps, right? And so this set here is f inverse of, let's call this little y. But because of this picture, people sometimes like to call that the fiber over this point. Okay. So, all right, so I'm finally done. So, questions? Yes. Exhausted applause. Okay. Yes. I'm going to go with Lucian first and then Rob.
So it seems like you could only have gotten to this model if you were thinking in the sort of mathematical way you do. Having got there, it'd be nice to see a physicist-friendly version of it, so I understand the Foyle theory.
That's right. I just need to find a friendly physicist.
Right. what I imagine it would look like, or that you can tell me differently, so would it look like this? You'd have a real Hilbert space, you'd have a set of allowed states that span that real Hilbert space, you have a set of allowed operators on that space that span it, and then you'd have a set of possible local measurements. Would it look like that, or am I completely off the mark?
No, not completely. You definitely will have the local measurements. Yeah. The local measurements are unsurprising. They are right, sort of by design, just what you think they are.
Okay, good.
The surprise, which was kind of buried in that one example we did at the end, is that in real quantum mechanics, if you take states and you restrict them to local, to just restrict your attention to what probabilities they assign to local measurements, you can represent that object, that restricted evaluating on local states object, you can represent that as an operator. But in general, it's not a positive operator. Right. So it was positive originally, right? Because you said it was a state, it was a density operator. But when you project onto the LSS part,
and it doesn't need to be positive.
It doesn't need to be, right, because I'm only evaluating at those local things, and it will give me positive probabilities there.
And then what about processes, like evolution in that theory?
Yeah, so that's kind of what we're getting at the end. So evolution is interesting. There's this notion of, well, think of it this way. There are going to be two kinds of processes. There are going to be processes that respect local indistinguishability. Meaning, if Alice and Bob can't tell the difference, you know, initially, they also can't tell the difference after you've applied the process. And there are a bunch of these processes, but not everything is like that. Those are the ones I called local or locally positive. Then there are the processes that actually can cause what were indistinguishable states to become distinguishable. So from Alice and Bob's point of view, that means that they thought they were looking at just one state, but now it looks like there are two after the process has taken place. The reason is that they weren't really looking at just one state. There were two different states here that they couldn't tell apart, that evolved separately, but now they've evolved into things they can distinguish. And this is sort of where the development right now has stopped with this question, right? I think rather than just saying artificially, we're not going to look at those. Those are part of the story.
And normally in operational theories, you'd say that the measurements include all things of the nature of evolution, data measurements. But you're kind of breaking that up.
I'm going to break that up a little bit here because, one thing that you can do for sure is you can say, well, you have this locally tomographic shadow, and now let's enlarge the collection of measurements that they can do and see what happens. And actually, that's an interesting idea because whatever you get should still be locally tomographic because you are ultimately still just making local measurements in some sense. Although, maybe this is sort of, what you're describing has a little bit of the flavor of a side channel, but it's not quite the same thing because you're still operating on the same pair of systems. So, yeah. But the other way to do it is to say, no, the measurements they can make are these local measurements. And just from those local measurements, it sort of looks like there's this extra indeterminacy. So maybe that should be part of the description of what they're seeing. Yeah. All right. Rob, you had a question?
Maybe I misunderstood, so you can just correct me. It felt like when you're defining the locally tomographic shadow that you were restricting the set of states to those that are positive on the product effect.
No. All states are positive on the product effects.
You're right. To those that can be characterized tomographically by product effects alone.
Well, I think better to say what I'm doing is I'm identifying states that can't be distinguished tomographically by product states alone. So the thing to have in mind is that the way this LT map works is it takes you from V of AB down to this thing. And it is surjective, but it's not injective. It will identify things, and in particular, it identifies, you can have different states here that go to the same state here.
Okay, good, that helps. Now, so here's my question. Have you also done the same in the vice versa? Because I could say, well, over on the effect space, I could identify that, I can talk about tomography effects relative to states, which effects can be tomographically by product states alone, and now let me identify those effects which
look the same. I haven't, but I think that it's going to work analogously.
And wouldn't that somehow be a more natural foil theory, given that we kind of like the democracy that exists between states and effects? It would be a bit bizarre to do this for states.
I'm not entirely sure. I think, first of all, because I'm less of a Democrat than you, so politically not. But when it comes to states and effects, I don't necessarily think that they need to be treated on an equal footing. I think they're conceptually quite distinct things.
Your equal love of the min and max tensor product made me, think you were down.
I don't love either of them, actually. I'm equally lacking in love for the minimum and the maximum tensor product. They're just they're useful tools. That's all. It's mere servants. one shouldn't get emotionally attached to one's servants. Okay, further questions? Yes?
I guess I can just say really quickly how I see the connection to the gauge symmetry.
Okay, yes. Yes.
I don't know if it would be a direction towards a more physicist friendly. Any real Hilbert space, you can define it as the real part of a complex Hilbert space. So you're imposing some constraint there. You're saying, the anti-symmetric projector equals zero.
Yes.
And also, so that's the same thing you do in direct quantization, you know, you impose a constraint.
Okay.
And that projector there is a non-local operator, so.
I would like to hear more about that, actually.
And another way to think of gauge
right.
theories is exactly theories where, or systems where this local topography fails because you have non-local degrees of freedom.
Okay, yeah. Well, we should talk more. I'd like to hear more about that.
There is a question online.
Okay.
From David Schmidt.
Ah, okay. Hey, David.
So, Alex, you're the thing.
Hey,
I can hear you.
I can hear you now, yes.
So if I understood right, your definition of probabilistic theory assumes the no restriction hypothesis?
This version, yes, it does.
Okay. Using that on the slides, maybe I missed it. So is that actually needed for your results?
I don't think so. I actually, as I was working on this stuff with Howard and Matthew, sort of on the side, I tried to sketch out what things would look like without local tomography, and everything looked like it was, without the no restriction hypothesis. And everything seemed to be working okay, but the notation got more complicated, and at a certain point, I just stopped because I had to get the QPL stuff ready. So unfinished business, for sure.
Got it, thanks. Yep. I'll just also mention that Roberto Balgihau at ICTQT has been working on this same topic. And as far as I know, he's proven a lot of the same results independently.
Oh,
cool. Maybe you haven't been assuming the no restriction hypothesis, right? He's here also with me, so
okay,
I'm just asking him.
Yeah.
Yes, I think we haven't been assuming the no restriction hypothesis, okay. But in some sense also, I think we make some other assumptions. If you're interested, we can sometimes chat about it. I'd
like that very much. Yeah. Yes. Thank you.
Yeah. No. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks.
I wanted to draw a connection between your notion of this locally tomographic shadow and something that shows up in the study of asymmetry.
Okay.
It'll also be connected to arriving quantum circuits. If I tell you, so like in the study of symmetry and reference frames, if I say, hey, all my measurements are symmetric with respect to the action of this group, then suddenly I get equivalence classes of states. These two states might look different, but they give the same prediction for all the symmetric mm-hmm. measurements.
Right.
So I may as well call them equivalent.
Yes.
And one thing you can do is say, oh, I'm going to apply the group twirling operation to them. And I can define equivalence as all the states that get mapped to the same thing by the group twirling operation, they're in the same equivalence class.
Okay.
So that state, that new theory you get, if you just twirl everything with mm-hmm. symmetry, you can think of that as a kind of superselection rule. So either mm-hmm. abelian or non-abelian symmetry, it'll sort
okay.
of be different.
Okay.
But you can say, well, let me restrict the theory which is induced by this superselection rule associated with this group. And so what you're doing is similar to that. But moreover, if you were democratic with respect to the states and the effects, then you know, many years ago, I thought about how you can consider the sort of difference between real and complex mm-hmm. as an instance of imposing of a symmetry, or the reduction from complex to real. Namely, like the twirling operation would be, you know, with probability half I do identity, with probability half I do the complex conjugate. That will take me down to the real.
Mm-hmm.
And so I suspect that if you, you know, did the democratic version of this, it would be the same thing as sort of this other reduction
mm-hmm.
where you just define as equivalent yeah. all states whose
yeah.
Twirling in this sense gives you the same thing.
I suspect that that's right. That sounds very plausible. And it also prompts me to remark that this whole idea of taking, you know, larger state spaces and factoring out some notion of, you know, observational equivalence, it's a very broad idea. And so, you know, you don't have to talk only about locally tomographic shadows. You can talk about, you know, all kinds of other things. You can look at hidden variables from this point of view. So I wouldn't be surprised to see, you know, something like that working and encompassing what we've done here as a special case, at least in the real quantum case. And then in the more general case, you'd have to ask, is there some group that, you know, implements this? I suspect not always, but. Well, maybe. I'd have to think about that. But it's an interesting idea.
mean, relative to how I used to think about it, what sounds new to me is I think in the past, I had appreciated that if I just take real quantum theory for composite systems versus, you know, the image of the complex quantum theory under this twirling operation, I get different things. You know, because if the conjecture is correct, that this is the same, it's not the same as real quantum theory. It's
no, this is not.
Adding some extra
books. Yes, yes, yes.
So yeah, that I think was not obvious before.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it has some conceptual implications. Like, you know, this twirling operation, at the time, I thought, oh, maybe we can conceptualize that as there's some sort of like reference frame that tells you whether, you know, you're one of those creatures in the universe that's traveling forward in time or one that's traveling backwards in time. And if you don't know which it is, then, you know, you apply this operation.
Yes, yes.
Your foil theory would be sort of appropriate for people who don't share a reference frame for this kind of thing.
Okay, okay.
I mean, it's a bit outlandish, but...
Well, I like outlandish. So. Good, good. All right. Thank you, everybody, for sticking around. If you have other questions for me, you know, I'll be around. Just, you know.
How long have you been around for this particular
thing? I should be here through the 26th, tentatively leaving the 27th of March, and then I'll be back, I guess, sort of early to mid-April after that.
Thank you.
So, all right. Well, thanks again. Thank you. I greatly appreciate your patience.